to order, and we'll open the public hearing for Senate Bill 5532 for the Oregon State Marine Board. And I think where we left off yesterday was that Lori Byerly, it was your turn to inform us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, I'm Lori Byerly from the Department of Administrative Services Budget Management, and I'm the analyst assigned to the Marine Board. If you'll find the packet that was given out yesterday, it's like this. We're going through that. I don't have the nice large flip charts that the Marine Board gave you yesterday, so I have to follow along in this smaller packet. And turn to the second page of the packet. You see a budget comparison of the Marine Board's budget over time. It gives you some actuals, current biennial expenditures, and also the column showing the governor's balanced budget. Governor's balanced budget for 03-05 is $27 million total funds. And basically, this is a similar or actually a higher level version of information that Paul provided to you yesterday. You'll see that the bulk of the revenue for the department is other funds, with a piece of federal funds coming in primarily for facilities grants. Page 3 shows you
the government. If I could just clarify that increase because of the fee increase. That's assuming the fee increase passes.
Yes, Chairman, Mr. Lingers, and members of the subcommittee. The 28% increase you see on the other funds is directly related to the proposed fee increase and the associated expenditures coming along with that revenue. Page 3 of the slides, or handout, shows you the governor's budget by fund type. Once again, it's primarily other funds. With this interesting, the graph that mine says it's 81% other funds. I have a type one, my version, and 90% federal funds. Federal funds come from a couple different funding sources: recreational boating safety, the Clean Vessel Act, boating infrastructure grants, and the budget on the other fund side is supported by marine fuel taxes. And I think you recall from the slides yesterday that's a rather large portion of the other funds, along with those registration and title fees, which does include that proposed fee increase. The next page just kind of gives a high-level view of some of the things that's in the governor's budget. It's a 20% increase from the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget to the fifth special session. It requires additional fee revenue to maintain core activities. Once again, yesterday we discussed how the department needs to make reductions in order to align services with the existing revenue stream, which is why it's proposing the fee increase. The governor's budget would increase direct services to stakeholders. Paul explained yesterday that there are packages in the budget that would expand facility grants, increase law enforcement, as well as provide some information technology and safety education activities for the board. Page 5 shows the governor's budget for the Marine Board based on those program areas we discussed previously. Facility programs takes the second to largest chunk at 39%, administration and education, 17%, and law enforcement, remaining 44%.
Lori, is it possible to break the administration out from the education?
Chair Messerly, Representative Morgan, we could go back and try. It's not structured that way. It's pretty much melded, but we go back and look at and see if we can pull out, like, the mandatory education piece.
I think that it might be interesting for the committee to be able to look at the pure administrative costs.
Chair Messerly, Representative Morgan, there would be a piece, there would be some administration costs also within those other program units, if I'm not mistaken.
Paul? Yes.
So there would be in facilities and law enforcement as well. There is some administration in those pieces. This is the overall kind of agency administration that's parked in that particular program unit.
Is that the way that it's usually done in all the agency budgets, where you have administration of departments in the department budgets?
Chair Messerly, Representative Morgan, I think typically an agency will have one area which is the biggest chunk of administration, but when it comes actually on the program unit level, there's probably always going to be some component of administration at that program level. It's real difficult to separate all those pieces out centrally, especially if they're very program-specific administrative-type functions. So I think you'll find a blend. But okay, generally, there usually is a piece parked somewhere in the main program.
Fine. I would just like to see how much this is administration and how much is education, because that's kind of it's difficult to make an assessment of how much of the budget is pure administration with that other item chunked in there.
Chair Messerly, Representative Morgan, we'll try to bring that back to you before we get to work questions. Page 6 is the governor's budget. By budget category, shows that the largest portion is 69% special payments. Those are the payments going out largely to the law enforcement contracts, as well as some facilities. About half and half of that, about $9 million of that is facilities types of special payments for grants. The remainder is for the law enforcement activities. So a small portion of capital outlay, as Paul mentioned yesterday, the agency does have capital outlay expenditures for things like boats and stuff they need to maintain internally for operations, so that's what that pertains to. The law enforcement portion, it's about $9.9 million in special payments. $1.6 million of that is what approximately is what's going to Oregon State Police for the Fish and Wildlife slash marine law enforcement piece. The remainder, about a little over $8 million, is what goes out to the counties.
$8 million goes where? To the county?
For the county law enforcement. If you represented Morgan.
It would be
8.3. Yes. I think 8.3 and 1.6 gets to 9.9. First time I checked. The next page, page 7, is kind of the budget creation process. Just like with all other agencies, we started with the 2103 legislatively adopted budget for the agency. That was 21.1 total funds. Added in some legislatively approved actions that occurred over the course of the 2103 biennium. That included a November 2001 emergency board, which approved $1.3 million federal funds for construction of boating facilities. House Bill 5091, passed during the third special session, added limitation for employee salary and benefit compensation adjustments. The October 2002 emergency board added $16,000 to support expenditures resulting from position reclassification actions. When Paul was describing the organizational chart for the board yesterday, he talked about some shifting they had made, and we brought that stuff to the E-Board for approval. The department had been directed by a budget note to look at its structure and the best way to deploy its resources. The budget also includes some base budget adjustments, rolling up of 2103 position actions and compensation changes, and I realize that we'll be making some adjustments to projected merit increases as we pull this into the budget as we move along. Page 8, after those base budget adjustments were made, some essential package actions were taken. There was increases for mass transit tax and vacancy saving adjustments. Package 030 had inflation and price list adjustments. I believe there's also discussion about pulling out some of those inflation type adjustments as we move forward into 2003-05. Package 050 contained a small fund shift. The dollars, the agency received some dollars which originate at the federal level that come through Fish and Wildlife and had been pulling those in as federal funds. Technically, since they come from another state agency, that's really an other fund type of action and expenditure. So we just switched that from a federal recording to an other funds recording. It's a net zero package. Just made that technical adjustment. On the next page, we'll move into the agency's policy packages in the governor's budget. And what I've done, Paul went into a lot of detail yesterday about each of these by program area. This is just going to summarize them at the agency level. So you'll see these packages across program lines kind of lumped together to give you the overall impact of the agency. The first package, package 070, makes some expenditure reductions to align with the agency's current law revenue projections based on the current fee structure. Took about $1.3 million in expenditure reductions in order to match up with anticipated revenues. Part of that eliminated one position, and it reduces agency services across all program areas. Paul explained part of the process that they went through with stakeholder meetings was to discuss if you take that cut, how do you do it? And the consensus was we want to do it across all programs, not focus on one particular area. Package 100 is what would implement the fees that the department has proposed in its legislation. It would bring in $4.9 million, about $5 million in revenue. This package brings that revenue into the budget and distributes it out to the program units. It's strictly a revenue type of package. The revenue adds fee increases that are proposed in House Bill 2247, and it supports service restoration as well as additional policy packages on top of that service restoration. Packages 101, 201, and 301 is implementing those service restorations in the program units. So those two sets of packages in combination brings the agency basically back to the same level of service it has in the current biennium in 2103.
Mr. Chair, could I kind of recap this to see if I'm getting the picture here? So what I think I heard you say was that if that There will be revenue shortfalls of just over $1.3 million if we do nothing at all. If we choose to implement or send out the fee increase, the boat registration increase package, then we'll be able to restore both 100 and 101, 201, and 301 from that?
Yes, Chair Messer, Labor Representative Morgan, that's correct. These would restore those cuts that had to be made to match revenue.
And how come, if I might ask, do you have them broken down? Why isn't there just one package of restorations that go with the fee then?
Chair, Mr. Representative Morgan, on the budget technical side, there are some options about how to present packages. I think for this agency, we broke them out with separate numbering schemes. If you looked at all the packages of administration, they would all begin with the 100s. If you were to look at all the law enforcement, they would all be 200s. It's more of an organizational scheme. You can put a one package number in and split it out, but if you're, it gives you an opportunity to kind of isolate things by program area if that's your desire.
Thank you.
Just doing the same thing, it's just the different program areas that kind of identifies people.
I can see what you're doing. Thanks.
If you'll turn to the next page.
Page 10.
Policy packages continued. Package 102, which is in the administration education area, would support safe and sustainable boating at $306,000. It supports life jacket safety, clean boating, and promotion activities. The next series of packages, 103, 203, and 303, are the information technology improvements that the agency is requesting. These packages would strengthen and improve computer infrastructure in all the agency's programs. Package 104 and 304 are two position reclassification actions that were approved at the October 2002 Emergency Board. This package pulls those forward into 2003-05 due to timing issues. Those were not items that would automatically roll forward into the next biennium's budget.
Yes, Senator Representative Johnson.
Forgive me if this is covered. If those position reclasses don't happen, how seriously, I mean, if for some reason they end up coming out, how seriously does that impact the Marine Board's ability to deliver their programs?
Chair Masterly, Representative Johnson, I believe the department made a strong effort this during the biennium to, based on its budget, to go back and review its structure and see where the best fit of services, and I think it's real comfortable with those decisions that have been made. The department would have to go back and revisit that and try to see if duties could be changed or moved around again to deal with the positions at a lower level. But I believe there was a lot of work and effort and review that went into making those changes. But, I mean, I'm sure the board could deal with it if that were to occur. It would undo some of the things that had worked to pull together this plan.
Mr. Chair, if I may just give a little bit of history on this issue, and please jump in here. The reclass was something that we dealt with extensively in the budget in the last session. And Senator Dukes was up to her eyeballs in that issue, too. Reclass, working out of class, all
yes.
that kind of stuff.
Yes.
And as was our loyal LFO person, too. And we ended up, I think, because of the discussions that we got into with the Marine Board, instituting this government-wide review of the whole process. Can you kind of give us the history of how all this kind of, what happened, and how the Marine Board got kind of worked over in the process?
Well, okay, I'll try. In the last session, this subcommittee had been receiving request after request from agencies on reclassifying positions, and it became a concern when this particular budget came before the committee and there was requests for reclassifications, that it was the reclassification of the director and an assistant, they were calling at that time a deputy. And there was some history along with that. The deputy had been removed from the agency as a cost-saving measure some years ago and had never been brought forward to the legislature for reinstatement or approval.
That's right. We eliminated the position and it came back.
Okay. So It's really just the process that agencies go through that became the issue. It's not necessarily this agency, but it's the statewide process for reclassifying positions. There are many mechanisms in place. They can an agency can do a financing package where they burn a position, where they use a position to reclassify another position. So they give up a position in order to increase a position somewhere else. They can come to the emergency board and request additional resources to reclassify a position to pay a higher level classification, or they can come to the legislature during their budget process to get that approved. There seems to be a growing amount of reclassifications upward and nothing ever going the other way, and it didn't seem to the legislature that there was much oversight of this process. And that is what is being borne out. Ways and Means Committee asked this department to go back and take a look at their organization and determine what the needs really are, and to do it without a deputy director. And the agency did do that and went back and looked at their organization, and there's very little overlap, if any, between the director and the positions that fall underneath. That does overlap are of necessity for practical reasons. When the director is out of town, there needs to be somebody who can make decisions or choices and speak on behalf of the agency. And so those kinds of things are built into the assistant position. It's not considered an assistant. The position was reclassified to a principal contributor, which is another policy kind of position that assists in across the agencies. What else do you want to know about this? It was the problem that we have with the process is that DAS was supposed to do work with the agency on this. DAS reviewed what the agency gave them. DAS did not go in and do a reclassification review and interview the employees to ensure that they actually really were doing the tasks that they should have been doing. DAS did not review the agency's organizational restructuring. They read it and said, yes, it meets the intent of the budget note, but they didn't actually go in and do anything. They use terms to classify positions that don't exist in law or policy. It's just practice. For example, the director is being paid, I think still, in an overfill capacity, administrative rules for classification, we have underfill and we have double fill, but we don't have overfill in order to accommodate changes in people's classifications other than what the legislature has established. The legislature sets the classification, except during the interim, then there are some mechanisms for changing that. So it's still kind of an issue. It's still a question about, how does DAS manage this process? What audit is being done when positions are being classified? How is it being verified? And that sort of thing. And I think the legislature needs to be very cautious, I guess, about decisions that we make here at this level when we're approving classifications, to ensure that we're not creating a problem later on where everybody is bumping up against the top and then we have to go out and raise the top levels in order to keep everything in order.
That was very helpful. Thank you.
Huh? Way more than you want to know.
Well, helpful, because I haven't had the benefit of having this discussion previously. Some of the veterans on the board had that history, and I appreciate having it. one other question. That might be an element in this discussion is a natural tendency of agencies that have a great deal of constituent support to keep trying to do more to satisfy constituents and necessarily have program creep to a point where you've got a whole bunch of people who have slid into different duties in an attempt to satisfy constituents, and suddenly you've taken a whole bunch of principal contributor A's and made them F's.
And, you know, that's where we have to hold the agency accountable to their core mission and responsibilities, and when they are stepping outside of those boundaries, help them explain to their constituents that they're not funded to do that kind of thing.
Kind of an underlying issue that I think all of us found frustrating was that the reclassification position and the salary creep thing was taking place outside of the venue of the legislature, that it was happening in a relationship with the agencies and DAS, or in some cases the agencies are able to look at their own reclassifications and judge whether they have merit or not. And we were much interested in introducing more legislative oversight back into the process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we thought we had. We brought in the head of DAS, and we had this agreement because, as it turns out, they didn't review all of the reclassifications. And in looking at some of them that they had supposedly reviewed, they had second thoughts after they actually looked at them. And so we thought that they were going to help us put together a system that made sense and made sure that every reclassification was actually visited. Because the situation we found was just what Representative Johnson was describing, and everybody said, well, yeah, the duties they're doing fit this other classification, so we're going to reclassify them into that other classification. And nobody ever asked whether we really needed them to be doing those other duties, which is the situation we found ourselves in last session when we said, wait a minute, we got rid of that position before. How did it come back? I still don't know how it came back, but it did. It was alive and well and being reclassed into something else. And we said, hang on, we made a decision that we didn't need that. You may think you need that, but we made a decision that it was not necessary, and we got rid of it. And I'm starting to wonder, I don't think we've got the authority to do that. We have the legal authority to do it. Maybe I should say, not that we don't have the authority, we don't have the power to do it. We have the authority, we don't seem to have the power. And we were all told that that's something we're supposed to look at this session. When you can't give pay increases, you start seeing more people applying for reclassifications. It's very understandable, but suddenly we end up with all the money. I actually had an agency head explaining to me the other day that there was not a problem with reclassifications as long as you had vacancies, and so you took the money from the vacancies and used them for reclassification, and that didn't cost any more money. And I said, what do you think the roll-up costs are? And they were just shocked to think that it actually cost anybody money when they did it that way. I said, maybe we could have taken the vacancy that you're choosing not to fill and eliminate that one, and we would have saved some money. Instead, you're using that money to pay a higher salary, and then we get to pay for the whole thing. The vacant position is still there the next session, so sure, then eventually you fill that one, and we've got the reclassification and the roll-up costs from that as well.
We did, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we did refer the broader issue of reclassifications to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee with the suggestion that it might be something that they'd like to partner with the Secretary of State Audit Division on a performance review of some sort, and the committee thought that would be the audit committee would be a good thing to do if they were successful in getting the joint audit committee to be active during this legislative session, something that could be going on at the same time. Now, I know that they've put in legislation for that. I don't know what the status of that is and where that's at, but it is still of concern to leadership.
Can somebody explain to me why every reclassification doesn't go through DAS and why DAS doesn't look at every one of those to say, do we need this? Not are they doing that work, but do we want them to be doing that work?
Well,
and do we?
I think we get some good questions.
Not your fault. I understand that.
But not only the reclassification, but vacancies too. Yeah, I don't think we've had a report on that yet.
Chairman Slee, Senator Dukes, if you'd like, I'll address the issue of this reclass issue in general, and then if you'd like, Paul can talk about specifically the department and its vacancies and how that's been working.
Yeah,
I lost my train of thought. Oops.
All I can say is Mike promised us last session.
I know he did.
Every reclass.
Chairman Slee, Senator Dukes, what I can say is it, in order for a reclass to actually occur, to be done, performed in the system on the position/budget side, Department of Administrative Services does have to key that. They have to take some kind of physical action to make that happen. That's position/budget side of the system. Part of the dynamic here is on the whole personnel, hiring, personnel policy side. There's kind of a parallel system around reclassifications and position issues where employees under union contracts and under DAS policy can go make requests about, you know, I don't think I'm working at this level, and initiate these actions. And there are specific, you know, parameters in union contracts that say what the process is going to be, what the agency has to do. And a lot of that, depending on the agency and whether or not they are certified by DAS HRSD, which is the Human Resource Services Division, some agencies are certified to handle that personnel side completely internally. It's large agencies, ODOT, I think maybe DHS. There's not a lot of them that are doing it on their own. And I think that came about because the workload to review all those pieces was simply too much for DAS to handle. And so I think that was something that happened a few years ago to alleviate that. But at some point, that action to actually be implemented in the budget does have to come through DAS. And in my role as a budget analyst, stuff that comes through me, I do routinely send down to HRSD to provide a secondary review, even if it has been reviewed by an internal personnel unit at the agency. And they don't always agree. So there is some conflict there.
Anybody ever ask when the budget was set up before, when the last budget was approved, it was based on certain expectations, workload and lots of things. Does anybody ever say, was this where we were headed?
Chairman Slee, Senator Dukes.
I don't think so.
As an analyst, I try to look at that, but a lot of times the stuff is coming in little bits and pieces. There's a couple positions in this unit, so it's a struggle sometimes to get your arms around the whole agency and what it's doing. Sometimes reclasses are a result of actions that were taken during the legislative session. Although we do fiscal impacts for packages and for legislation, we don't always know what the outcome is going to be in terms of agency workload. So sometimes it is a result of things that changed in the previous session. Sometimes it is a result of internal changes in the agency. I think sometimes individuals and their strengths play a role in what happens with positions and what happens with people in the organization. If you've got someone with a set of certain skills that are a lot stronger than the previous person, maybe they come into the role and actually do more and get reclassed up. I can tell you as part of the funding for reclass packages, there are positions that do get reclassed down. The agency looks at them in whole and says, you know, we want to realign our resources. We'd like to bring these people up to a little different level, but we have some people over here that we don't really need at that higher level. We'll bring them down here and we'll fill them at that level and maybe change their duties slightly. So there is some shift back and forth, but I think what is most visible is the reclass up, and I know there's a trend in that direction. I spoke with HRSD earlier this week, and they did work on some reviews of agency head positions over the interim, and I think it's been difficult to wrap up that review because what they have found is there are some compensation issues out there and compression issues. As union representative positions go up, they're bumping into those managers, and we know right now there's no money to alleviate that problem. So I have a feeling that's going to be something set aside for a while until there's a way to address that. Did that help at all? Or?
Yeah, you just...
I'd like to what we heard from Susie and how DAS approached the reclassification examination. Would you like to respond to that?
Sure, Chair Messerly. Her comments on, you know, the HRSD just looked at the paper material. They didn't go into the agency and spend time, you know, actually interview all the employees. And she's right in that there are, you know, a lot of times the process will be kind of a paper process. The agency reports on paper the changes that are occurring. Here's the new position description. Here's what's changed. And when I worked in personnel a long time ago, we called that a desk audit. We called that a paper audit. A desk audit is when you go in and you sit next to the person, you watch what they're doing, maybe you follow them around for part of the day, and you get a better feel of what it takes to do that role. The time involved between those two processes is significantly different. I know we don't have the resources statewide to go in and do one of those close one-on-one audits with every individual that requests one. And there are, like I said before, provisions for agency employees to request an audit, and the agency has to respond. They can't say no under union contracts and DAS policy. The agency has to come and do something. And I think a paper type audit is what often takes place simply because of time and resource constraints.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
And what I'm wanting is that at some point in there, before it's approved or denied, that somebody looks at it and says, can we afford this? Did we intend this? I think a good manager will take any good employee and use them to their maximum potential. And that will often mean using them in areas that weren't in the original job description. And I don't fault a manager for doing that. And certainly, if you're the employee, you have a right then to come in and say, I'm working more than, you know, we expected, and I should be compensated for that. But for me, then, the question is, do we need that person to be doing it? Can we afford that person to be doing that? Do we really want that person to be doing that? Or given the budget constraints, do we need them back down there? Or given the, that's how you end up with less money out there on projects and more money into management, mm-hmm. into administration. And I just don't think that there's anybody in that last one saying, I think that it's simply a matter of saying, are they working in that capacity? If they are, then yes, we reclass them into that.
Chair, Mr. Senator-Dukes, and I think you're right, especially on the personnel side of it. That's what HRC is looking at.
We're never going to get ahead of
this
the
appropriate. And maybe there probably should be a way for the budget side and the personnel side to work more closely together. What I was thinking about a little bit earlier as vacancies were being discussed, and I know the plan is to take away vacancies that are sitting out there, is that could very well have I wonder what the effect of those vacancy removals is going to have on current classifications, because if those are taken, depending where they are, they may drive positions to do different duties than they did before. They're having to, if those are vacant, but they're still an essential function, there may be that other positions are going to have to take on some of those roles, and that might drive additional types of reclass actions. I don't know if that's something that subcommittee's been thinking about, but depending on where those come from, it could really change the dynamics of what happens in the agency and may shift some work.
Well, having missed out with this hallway moment here, during the special sessions and the rebalances, one of the things that we did try to do to capture efficiencies within the agencies without dropping back on the service levels was to try to find all those vacant positions and bring them forward and essentially defund them but put them on a list. And one of our jobs here is, if they do have vacant positions, trying to figure out whether they actually should be having bodies in them or where the money actually was going inside the agency. And if it's going other places, then talking about truthing the budget up so that you actually are attributing the correct number of dollars to the place where the money was going before.
Holden, do you want to comment?
Thank you,
Joel. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm having a bad deja vu here. All over again.
Representative Johnson and I were here to enjoy that.
Yeah. I don't think anybody enjoyed that, Mr. Chair.
Still got marks to show for it. The only thing I would like to add to this discussion is that we did take a hard look at the budget note that was given to us last session. We took it to heart. I think we did a good faith effort at looking from one end to the other of our agency as a part of that review.
While it is true that the Human Resources Policy Division didn't come out and do desk audits, I think we did comply with the note that was given to us, and in reporting back to the October Emergency Board, they recognized that we had done that. But as part of that review, we did we eliminated one manager position. We shifted things around. We reduced another accounting position. And with the savings from some of those changes, we had other managers that were moved up as a part of that process. So there was a releveling within the agency, but it was all done within the net savings. Now, the one position that did cause us to go to the October Emergency Board was the principal contributor position. There weren't savings to do that, and that was a part of the report back. The report back was specifically to address that position. We were told in the budget note, come back to the emergency board and report on that. That's what we did. That received quite a bit of scrutiny from the personnel side in reviewing it, and they determined that that principal contributor position was in fact operating at that level. It is not a management position. It's not in the principal executive manager series. They approved it. Putting in our budget was necessary because the October Emergency Board was too late for that action to roll up. Had it happened prior to April, we wouldn't be here probably discussing it because it would have just been in the base budget, I imagine.
Still have the report.
So we would have had the we would have had the report to the Emergency Board, but. Every time there's a request for reclassification, sometimes these are driven from employees. You know, they're working and doing additional work, and they feel that you know they're working out of class. And those things are reviewed by Human Resources Services Division. They don't just rubber stamp them. They do get a serious review, and in some cases they get denied or not approved. So it's not just a slam dunk and they go upstairs and are approved. It's it is a rigorous process of looking at it, and I think we've done the best we could with the budget note and in trying to comply with that. And with that, I don't have anything else to add to this discussion unless you have a question.
Mr. Chair, I just want to comment. It's not a rigorous review. When we went through all of this last time, DAS claimed to be really surprised that you were working out of class and really surprised that a position that had been eliminated was back in the agency and had approved reclassifications that we pointed out to them that they had approved. They were chagrined to find out that they'd been approved. So, I mean, it was, and Mike was very clear to us that there were some reclasses, not all of them, but some of them that were being processed as just sort of, yeah, okay, they're, you know, with very little knowledge and no back paperwork backup behind it. So I would like to get to the rigorous review, and I suspect at this point you would as well, and maybe your agency is getting that, but overall it's not happening.
I concur with Senator Dukes. I think that having sat on the audit committee in the interim and got the letter from the co-chairs and had the issue put in the audit committee, that it was real dissatisfying, the quality of work that was done on the system issue as a whole. And, you know, I think one of the problems is now that we find ourselves thrown into this fiscal disaster area that we're in, that this may end up, given the task that the audit committee has, being one of those things that gets put on the back burner again.
Well, I think it's helpful, though, that we're having this discussion and with the different agencies that come before at least our committee and other ones we serve on in this Ways and Means process. I just have to say, though, that we do need the checks and balances, no doubt about it. But we also have to be careful that we as a legislature don't start micromanaging. I think we do need to hold the departments and the directors accountable for whatever actions they take. But some cases, not in every cases, but I very strongly get the feeling that the legislature really does get into some micromanaging I'm not saying in this case, but in some cases we get into areas that we really should, don't need to be in that area. We are a policy board, and we balance and we set the budgets. And that's our responsibility and our authority. And I think we always, you know, that balance is something that we also need to think about. Matter of fact, as we're serious, I guess, as I've mentioned in our education committee, that as we go through the performance measures and the benchmarks and all of this stuff, I worry a little bit that we're not creating such a massive paperwork, and are we going too far? And what we really want is a report so we can judge whether they're meeting their obligations within their authorities. And I think we need to be very cautious there, too, that we're not creating just a monster of a paperwork for them to deal with. Are there any more questions? We do have some other issues that we've asked the department to come back with us today. And are there any other questions of Lori or Paul on this issue? Paul, would you like to go through some of the other information, such as the benchmarks that I see we received here? Or were you through, Lori? I'm sorry.
Chair Master, when I was in the committee, there was one page left, but its package was covered yesterday. So.
Paul? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, again, for the record, I'm Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. I'd like to note that I have with me one of our board members, Don Christensen, a longtime member of the Marine Board, is here today.
Don's been here all week with us.
One budget or another.
And you're on full-time payroll, right?
And I've also got Bill Reedbloom, our Law Enforcement Program Manager, to help me with some of the questions, and Hillary Crew, our fiscal manager. Regarding the performance data summary, that is an updated handout that we've provided today. We went back and have included now targets for several of these. Number three, which deals with building under the influence by operators and passengers, we included a 2003 target in there. We've also added targets for 2003. In item four, voting fatalities as part of the national average. Number five, compliance with the mandatory education requirements. We've added targets in there. And then we've added targets for number 8, 9, and 10 as well for 03. There are still some gaps in here, most notably for 2004. And part of that is the fact that we do our triennial survey. It's a triennial survey. Every 3 years we do the survey. We won't have data for some of those in-between years. So we haven't tried to fill in targets where we're not going to have any data to measure it up against. But we do have targets for 05 for all the areas. And that's the end of the next coming budget cycle. So we do have targets that we're aiming for the conclusion of the next 03-05 budget.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, Representative Morgan.
I'm looking at the one that is it's the dash for performance measure, voting fatalities in Oregon as a percentage of the national average. And I'm thinking, you know, if the goal is to allow 125% of the national average of people to die, what are we talking about here in terms of lives?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, it's not our goal to have anybody die in a boating accident. But Oregon does have hazardous waters, most notably the Pacific Coast, the Columbia River Bar, all of our coastal bars. And so Oregon's fatality rate has been higher than the national average. What we're trying to illustrate here is that we want to reduce that being above the national average, if you will. In 2000, we were at 130% of the national average, or 30% above the national average, and we want to drop that by at least 5% going out to 2005.
But may I have a follow-up?
Sure.
If you were to kind of scrape together all the states that have the same kind of water conditions that Oregon does, where are we at in that pool of people in terms of how the norm of people dying?
Chairman, Representative Morgan, we were asked that question by the Progress Board as we were grappling with this one, and the answer is that it's very difficult to find comparable states to Oregon to compare fatalities to because of the uniqueness of the Pacific Northwest, cold water, our particular mix of rivers, lakes, ocean. To try to normalize that and compare us to another state or group of states would be difficult. So we decided to go with
Washington. Must be pretty comparable. I mean, they got the river on the south edge. We got it on the north edge, and the ocean and the mountains and
Idaho. Yeah.
But they have the sound.
Yeah, they have Puget Sound. They have a different. They do have a different mix of waters than we have. And in truth, we'd probably look very good if we were to compare ourselves with Washington because on average, the last several years, they've had over 30 fatalities a year. And I'm happy to say that Oregon has kept our numbers down in the teens. So so we're doing quite a bit better than the state of Washington. But in working with the Progress Board on this, we kicked it around several different ways, and after going back and forth with them, we concluded that comparing ourselves to a national average for that would be an appropriate way to measure it. There's no perfect calculus in this.
Is that on a per thousand population or per?
Yes, it would be.
Hillary, that one's on a per 10,000.
So it's comparing rates.
Or could it be based on the boat registrations or something? Because some states obviously don't have this one.
We looked at that. It could be done on a basis of registered boats, but then it's hard to compare boating in South Dakota with, you know, boating in Oregon or Kansas. So it's a difficult one. We really did wrestle with it, and it's an excellent question. And I'm afraid I just don't have a better answer. There's any number of ways that we can measure it. What we've been doing in the past is simply just using an absolute number and for fatalities. And on it, using an absolute number, we've been doing fairly well. Back in the 1960s, when we had half as many boats, Oregon was averaging about 40 fatalities a year. And as we moved into the 70s and 80s, we brought that down into the 30s, down into the 20s. Through the 90s, with nearly twice as many boats, we had a few years where we were in single digits.
Do you also include the near shore?
The near shore.
About 3 miles. Representative Prager?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, one other thing, you know, Oregon has, every 25 miles up the coast, we have a port. Not all those ports, even though we have bar crossings, are manned by the Coast Guard anymore, and they're also manned only for certain periods of years. And every year in September when they pull out of Gold Beach, we get a fatality too. It happened last year, it happened the year before, it's every year. Yet they don't man that. Also, that's going to become more of a problem when we lose our dredging in those ports because you're going to have rougher bar conditions. And also, we got the Scenic and Wild Rivers, which drew an awful lot of people to Oregon that historically did not know those rivers, weren't familiar with them, and a lot of them didn't take guided trips or with experts and went down. They went down themselves, and every now and then they get in trouble. So we do have unique conditions that cause fatalities.
Well, there's also a danger, I think, and I became aware of this on the bar on the Coquille River, where as the Coast Guard backs off, as Representative Prager just alluded to, we're seeing local fire departments with jet skis try to fill the gap. Very dangerous. Not very well trained in many cases. And is there anything the Marine Board, are you involved in that in training those people or helping them purchase equipment?
Chairman, no, we were not involved with volunteer fire departments and the like.
And we've had, in my district, we've had some really near misses. I'm not aware of any fatalities, but that's a really close call.
Chair, that's happened twice now in the Port Orford Gold Beach area with us. The Sheriff's Office, the search and rescue, they're right close there. You know, they're like a half a mile from the port. They get a call, they run down in a jet sled, a 20-foot jet sled. And you might have two guys 50 years old or more out there trying to rescue somebody because that's who was available. And even though they may have had some training, they really don't have the proper equipment and backup. If they get in trouble, then we just got more fatalities. And that will eventually happen.
Yes, Senator Duke?
I take it the boating safety inspection is optional.
Are you referring to item
question.
One?
Yeah. Is that an optional program?
No, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, when officers are out there in the course of their on-water patrols, they do conduct boating safety inspections, both on water and at the ramps, to check people for life jackets, fire extinguishers, other pieces of safety equipment. And those are boardings.
We're only aiming in 2005 to have 80% of the people of the boats pass that inspection. Is that just trying to deal with reality that there's going to be people out there who don't care about the law or forget about it or something? It just seemed low to me, but maybe that's the reality.
Paul, you're
78 is all we're dealing with next time. But
you're also talking about boardings on the water. They do stop boats on the water.
Yes.
I just, my initial response was, well, gee, why aren't we aiming for 100%? But you're always going to have people, and you know you're always going to have people who go out there and, you know, didn't put the life jackets on or don't care or don't pay attention. I guess we're saying that 20% of them.
Well, in my experience, too, riding along with the OSP Fish and Game officers when they, and having watched them do some boat checks on folks, that they take the attitude that you try to work with the people rather than just handing them their citation and getting them all head up and getting them angry and everything. So, I don't know. I think that, you know, what we want to look at here is that the programs are effective or not effective, and that's what these numbers are all about, whether we're getting, with the taxpayers' money, what the agency has said that they're going to give the taxpayers for the money. And I think we need to look at this also as kind of a work in progress, that this is the first time that we've really gotten cut and dried about putting these policies down on paper, and that we kind of have to give the process time to work and debug it and work with it as we go. But I would hate to see a situation where the numbers on this page drove the best practices out in the real world.
Maybe sometimes yes, sometimes no. I was just wondering if there was any correlation between number one and was that one you were concerned about boating fatalities?
Paul, could you expand on policy number seven? I don't understand what the standard is, I guess. And it seems like a low percentage that meet the standard.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to. That does speak for itself in the sense that many of our facilities are substandard. The board does have standards for construction of facilities, and whenever we can, when we're doing new construction or rehabilitation or renovation of a facility, we endeavor to bring it up to a standard. But I think what this speaks to is the fact that many of Oregon's boating facilities are in one way, shape, or form substandard. And that is part of what is driving our interest in additional investment in boating. boating facility grant so that we can raise that, raise the bar on the quality of the facility so they do meet standards.
In the case of restrooms at 12%, does that mean that they're not meeting water quality standards or your department standards or what?
No, Mr. Chairman, that could include things like handicapped accessibility. Certainly, if they were not meeting sanitary standards for water quality, they'd be closed down. If it was a failing drain field, or something like that, and we have cases like that. We've had one recently in Douglas County where they had a failing septic system, and worked with them to get it connected to a municipal system. But this could be a variety of other deficiencies, including but not limited to handicapped accessibility.
Representative Krieger.
Chair, if you recall, two state reps and a particular senator who happened to be in this room that had experience at a boat ramp in Coos County regarding restrooms, which caused many smiles and howls. And
actually, I believe
that was
only
I think, was really so you're okay. They just
did
aren't
Coos
being
County
maintained.
Get a new restroom?
They aren't being cleaned and refurbished and. There were comments made that day, so you've actually taken part and have personal knowledge in this.
In my inspection, my personal inspection. Well, let's note for the record that the Marine Board did not own that facility. But your point is well taken. I just should not think about that.
Any other questions on the benchmarks? The performance.
Well, I'd like to. Do you have anything else? I know we want to talk to you about enforcement too. Would you like to cover those issues?
Yes.
We ask some general questions.
It's up to you, Mr. Chairman. We are prepared to address several of the other issues that came up yesterday.
Let's do that.
One of those was the question of OSP, Oregon State Police training and the impact on service delivery. I asked Captain Cindy Cope to come to our hearing today to assist me with that. We don't have all the answers, and may not have all the answers either, but she can certainly help us on that discussion more than I can. So I'd like to ask her if she could help us with that.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Cynthia Cote, Captain of the Fish and Wildlife Division of the Oregon State Police.
Hi. And the question, we were concerned about the, as we're rolling out the state police, many of the dedicated police, such as game officers, are being replaced by highway patrolmen who... We've had some discussions about whether they were qualified, whether they had the training for identification or marine boat inspections. And is there going to be a lag before we get service for the funds we're expending for the personnel?
Senator Mesley, certainly I'm losing a quarter of my field force for a period of time. And I don't know how many of those people are going to be replaced. I think the agency is still waiting to see exactly if there's some kind of a backfill with some of the talk that's been going on. But it doesn't matter how many. I'm going to lose some officers, and they're going to be replaced with people either from the criminal division as detectives or patrol. And their level of expertise in marine enforcement on the majority of them is not going to be what it is that I'm just losing. I don't know what my pool of employees is going to look like yet. I haven't been given that information. Some people we have out there who are qualified. They were game officers, and they left the division within a fairly short, period of time, and so perhaps those will be some of the people the division is very concerned not just about the marine enforcement, but certainly all aspects of fish and wildlife enforcement. And fortunately, we are constantly in a mode of training, and we have the short course, we have the long course, we have many different ways that we think that we can try and step up, and especially when boating season starts here this spring, that we will be at some level of readiness. But are we going to be where I'd hoped that we would be with, you know, these officers that have been trained? They were hired for skill sets that they have. Absolutely not. I think that's, you know, preposterous for me to think that they would be.
I guess, and I don't know that we as a committee have discussed this, but I'm concerned that some of the dedicated funds that we have to deal with game violations and try to stave off nymphs coming to the state, if some of those dedicated funds won't be drawn off to backfill some of the other authorities of the state police. And my concern is that if that happens, it's going to be very difficult for us to look some of these funding sources in the eye and say that we're doing our job with the funds you're giving us. And I guess I'm looking for some protection, or at least some testimony that can assure me that can't happen or won't happen.
Well, just as now, the State Police Fish and Wildlife Division always has to keep their eye on where it is we're spending our time, because we do have so many different funding sources. And it's an issue that we have to address with our supervisors constantly. However, as we work in our watersheds and in our hunt units, we find that oftentimes the intent of getting to work fish and wildlife is often interrupted because there are these other general law kinds of issues, whether it's drunk drivers or other criminal acts occurring that take priority. I mean, we just can't turn away and walk away. The side of the truck says Oregon State Police, and I think that the public expects a level of service on those kind of issues as well. Will we keep our eye on that? Will our people be reminded as to what their core mission is? Yes, they will.
Representative Krieger.
I guess maybe explaining a little more on the ground, because I've been there, is when her officer makes out a daily report, for instance, it might have an hour of commercial fish, 5 hours of fishing game, 1 hour of traffic, and whatever he did during that shift is segregated. And that's how they keep track of that over the time, to make sure they can report to the agency specifically how many hours they had. And you may have a traffic officer who gets involved in a game activity, something to do with narcotics, and that's all separated out, and it's the total department, but they specify within the divisions the time that's actually spent.
Thank you, Representative. You also, Representative Krieger, raised a concern yesterday of the time away from on duty, at least, that some of these officers will spend certifying or taking courses. And could you give us a clearer picture of what that would involve? Is it going to be a week or two, or a month or two, or 6 months, or what?
Well, Senator Mesley, on the upside, we aren't having to train these officers, these men and women, to be police officers. They have that skill down. But certainly they're going to be out of their comfort zone in a remarkable fashion. And so until I know exactly what my field force is going to look like, it's hard for me to totally respond to the question. Certainly, we will have to look at what priorities we have, marine law enforcement being one of them, and how to best facilitate our commitment to that contract. I know, where we currently are, we're right where we should be. The state police, in the last two biennia that we've been involved in that contract, have not only met the contract, but we've exceeded it. And I don't want to make myself a liar here and say, we will do that same thing this time around. I definitely think that there will be, a loss of service. How we're going to actually provide training, we have not totally addressed that yet. We're still trying to meet out what the what item or what things we'll be dealing with for the rest of this biennium, fish issues, boating issues. There won't be a lot of big game issues, but really trying to go through and prioritize what it is these new people will need.
You mentioned you're going to lose 25% of your staff, I believe, or your officers. Is that right?
Approximately, yes.
What is the percentage of general fund to operate your department? Of your
my division? Excuse me?
Yes.
I believe it's about 20% of my about 23 million of authorized. I believe it's about 4.7 that comes from general fund.
I'm trying to make those percentages work.
I know. It's a little bit less
than 20%. How that works, we're so dedicated. Yeah.
Excuse me. Part of it is changed because of the 5 special sessions, and that's why it's a little hard for me to.
Well, thank you. Any other questions? Oh, excuse me, Senator Duke.
When do you think you might have some feel for how many people you're going to have? I mean, it occurs to me that we transfer money from ODFW and the Marine Board into your office, and I was just wondering if there will be cutbacks, and I would certainly expect there would be. I can understand everything's in upheaval at the moment. Well, when do you think we might have some idea as to how much those cutbacks are?
Chairman Esley, Senator Dukes, the cutbacks have already been made, so to speak. I lost 8 general funded troopers. Those are gone. The other 25 are people that were laid off that are from the funding source, either Marine Board, Lottery, or ODFW funds. Those 25 people will be filled. I have not been given the information from my department when that's going to happen.
Okay, so the other funds that you're getting from other agencies, you'll be able to fill those positions?
Senator Mosley, Senator Dukes, that's true. We haven't been cut those funds. Those have remained with us. That's why we're able to fill all 25
positions. Stanton told us that he was going to have one less fish and game. Yeah, and he was going to take it out of the commercial side of it. And
Senator Mosley,
Senator Dukes, the
commercial fish position was paid out of general fund. That program was cut from our budget.
Paid out of the commercial fish fund. Oh well. My other question is really for Paul. Last session we took money out, extra money, more money out of your budget to give to the state police. And one of the issues that we were concerned about was that prior to that, there hadn't been really a lot of reporting as to how the money was spent. Has that improved? Reporting piece?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dukes, we did address that during the interim and covered it in a report that we gave to the emergency board in October. This, I believe, your staff included a highlight of this in the in your briefing book. And certainly, we have a copy if you'd like the whole thing. But we did study the delivery of Marine law enforcement services statewide, both counties and state police. The short answer is yes, we are satisfied that we're getting an accounting for the time that they're doing that. But as a part of this report also, we looked at additional needs and gaps and other things such as that.
Good.
Okay. Paul, did you have other items you wanted to present?
Well, if I'm on the subject of the Marine Law Enforcement Plan, there was a question yesterday by Representative Morgan regarding the priority needs within this plan. And so I've included as a handout a couple of excerpts from the plan and the whole thing. You should have something that shows a table 8. And table 8 from the plan was the highest level of funding priorities that we winnowed out of all the needs that were identified to us as a part of the planning process. And then behind that are a series of tables, and they get kind of noisy because there's a lot of counties and a lot of data there. But if you go to the last of those tables, look towards the bottom, you will see our summary of Priority 1 and Priority 2 needs for the 03-05 biennium. It should be right at the bottom of that last graph. And you'll see Priority 1 and Priority 2 for personnel, maintenance, capital outlay, and then the total needs, the Marine Board share, and the county share of that breakdown. So the total needs identified out of this process were approaching $3 million. What we did in our policy package, which is within the budget, is we narrowed that down to just under $1 million, $966,000 that's contained on that Table 8. And that was the result of staff going through with a real sharp pencil and winnowing down that $3 million in needs to a package of $966,000. So that's how we broke that down. But these tables give you the complete breakdown of what was reported to us in terms of needs on a county-by-county basis. It was a fairly comprehensive at looking at things statewide as a part of that overall review.
Thank you.
Anything else?
The last thing, or two other things I'll just touch on very briefly. I've also included you. There was an interest yesterday in the subject of non-motorized boats, and I've included on your table there just excerpts from a 2001 study that we had done for the board on non-motorized boat registration. The first couple of pages give sort of the pros and cons of why it's a good idea, why it's not a good idea. These are arguments used by some of the supporters and opponents. They're not necessarily our arguments. These are the arguments that people use. We've estimated there on Table 1 and Page 3 of that report sort of the range of revenues that might be available given different levels of funding, different funding scenarios with registration fees. Beyond that, on pages 4 and 5, there's a history, a timeline of this issue before the legislature. And you'll see that in 1975, 76, and 78, there were legislative bills introduced to deal with it that failed to go anywhere. Resurfaced again in the early 80s. There were bills in 1983, three bills that came out of an interim House study, and none of those advanced. It popped up again in 87 and 89. With legislation that was introduced. One of the bills actually made it to the floor and failed. And then it resurfaced again in the late 90s with navigability discussions and river use discussions, although it didn't surface as a specific legislative proposal. There was an amendment to a Senate bill during one of those sessions. And most recently, in the last legislative session, a bill was introduced and referred to transportation last session. It didn't get a hearing and died. So that's sort of a legislative recap. There are a total of 9 states that have some form of non-motorized registration. A couple of them are voluntary, and most of them are fairly modest in terms of what they charge. Anyway, that I provided that to answer some of the interest that was expressed in that issue.
Thank you.
And then finally, we've included a packet of letters for you that we've received in our office regarding the fee increase and our budget. And I think these are representative of some of the stakeholders and interest groups that participated in the discussions that I mentioned yesterday. There are letters there from the Bass Anglers Association, the Columbia River Yachting Association, county parks, steelheaders, and others on that subject of the fee increase. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman, in terms of reporting back on items from yesterday.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
Senator Mazur-Manger, we're all here, and we have the captain here. You and I have had a discussion about the concern that if we don't have enough
game enforcement officer on the dock, how that might influence the feds to come in and kind of take over. And I wanted to maybe give her an opportunity to clarify. At one time, we had a commercial fish person, Coos Bay, Newport, and Astoria. That's been some time since I was involved in that, so I don't know what your configuration is now for manpower. But we didn't have one at Gold Beach. We didn't have one at Bend and these different ports. But the game officers who are there, I did commercial fish enforcement, all of it. Those hours went towards the toll. Are those officers still going to be allowed to do commercial fish enforcement in conjunction with their game activities? They're on the same docks. This boat comes, it's a commercial boat. That boat comes, it's a sport boat. Are you going to be telling them, no, you cannot check and enforce the commercial fish laws because you're not getting funded by, from any of their funds? Or are you going to make sure that there's a broad spectrum of enforcement until you get your people back?
Chair Breslis, Representative Krieger, that's been a concern, and the way we've addressed that is that we are unable to proactively go out and provide enforcement for commercial fishing. This is only a week old, obviously. We will respond to complaints. What happens on the docks happens on the docks, and sometimes you don't know how things are going to turn out until you're actually involved in the situation. We have some dire concerns coming up with possible tanglenet fisheries coming up on the Columbia, and we're dealing with ODFW and how to provide enforcement for that. It doesn't seem viable to offer a fishing season if you don't have enforcement for it. So it's an issue that we are definitely dealing with, but we aren't receiving funds for it, and I don't know that license and tag holders want their money spent for that kind of enforcement.
When you resolve what you're going to do with the tanglenet fishery, would you let me know?
I will. Excuse me, Senator Mesley, Senator Dukes, I believe some of that may be decided tomorrow because the Fish and Wildlife Commission meets, and I know that's on the agenda.
I think our entire committee would be interested in that.
Yeah, it would be.
I have a couple of issues I'd like to raise. Number one is in the facilities grants in your budget. I am curious, there's other people that build facilities or pay for facilities, have grants for facilities, such as I think ODFW does work and actually owns some access to waterways, and I don't know if they have restrooms and things, but how does that coordinate back and forth? And I guess really where I want to go is, would your organization be able to backfill, quite bluntly, some of those needs of ODFW to maintain their facilities? Or maybe you already do, I don't know.
Chair Mesley, we work very, very closely with the Department of Fish and Wildlife on their access projects for boating facilities construction. The funding that they have earmarked for that is 15% of the federal Wallop-Bro Trust Fund that comes down for sport fish restoration. It's earmarked for boating facilities or public access. Only be spent for that. And we meet with the department from time to time, compare our list of projects and needs with their interests, and we try to marry up our projects with their interests and actually pre-blend the dollars that are available for local sponsors on these, because theirs is a 75-25 matching program on the federal funds. So it's a good marriage. We give them, we provide the 25% minimum match for these, and then in turn we can turn around to a local government sponsor for the project and give them essentially a 100% blended project that's ready to go. So it's we've worked very closely with the department on those.
On some of the, and I'm familiar with 10 Mile Lakes in Coos County, there's a growing need, and I think some of our fishing rivers and things, there's a growing need for facilities on water. Have you got into that business? I think you might be involved in a few, but is that an area that you're trying to expand?
Senator Mesley, Mr. Chairman, are you referring to on-water restroom facilities? Yes. We have been funding those actually out of our Clean Vessel Act fund to our department. And we have a number of those facilities. I believe Coos County is the recipient of one of those. but I know we have them in we have them in Tillamook Bay, Lake Billy Chinook, Detroit, Green Peter, a number of our larger lakes and reservoirs. We've installed those facilities, and they're very popular.
Are you finding that takes a lot of pressure off the private landowners?
Well, I can't really respond to pressure on private landowners, but we know that they get well used because they're frequently pumped out, and that's a lot of waste that would have otherwise been going.
Helps the water quality.
Either into the waterway or into the adjacent lands, and more than just a simple convenience for boaters, we think it does protect water quality.
Thank you. My second area of concern is your work that your department can do in education and maybe enforcement of invasive species being brought to our waterways from on boats or, I mean, all kinds from vegetation to crabs. And Senator Dukes and I, and well, Representative Crager too, and we hear a lot about this in our fisheries task force when we go to other states. But what are you doing, or what are you able to do to help deal with the, I think to me it's a disaster waiting to happen, and we've been very fortunate we haven't been hit hard in Oregon yet.
Mr. Chairman, we are currently trying to do what we can within our current resources to educate boaters about that. A recent example would be our statewide newsletter that went to all registered boat owners, and there was some information in that about how to prevent the transport of various aquatic nuisance species. Within our budget, one of our policy option packages, the Safe and Sustainable Boating Package, has funding in it specifically to broaden that education effort in partnership with other agencies to try to spread that word to boaters about the problems of ANS. Bonneville Power has been very interested in working with us on that because they have some resources too. And so the answer is we're currently doing what we can, and with that package we hope to do much more.
We're pretty weak on enforcement and authority, aren't we, to enforce that issue?
Yes.
Are you meeting with other, such as state police or sheriff's departments, of what the needs are to gain that kind of enforcement or that authority to enforce?
I haven't had those discussions.
Representative Krieger.
Just one last thing. You talked about this invasive weeds and this type of thing. And yesterday we talked about the fact that you have to get a certification passed, the boater operators thing within something like 8-9 years. Everyone's got to be done. In that program, do you have anything regarding invasive species and stuff?
Chairman and Representative Krieger, we do try to cover a variety of topics other than boating safety within the...
I didn't remember when I took it.
Within the purview of...
Oops. You better take a refresher.
Yeah.
Educating boaters about that. And we have information about it on our website, boatoregon.com. As I said, it was in our newsletter. And we've highlighted it at boat shows and sportsman shows, trying to, you know, do outreach.
I'll look for it Saturday in Portland.
Knit and cram in a jar.
Yeah.
Are you aware of other states starting to enforce any boats or, you know, any of those kind of air inspections or anything?
I have to admit that I am not. I'm not that fully aware of what other states are doing.
Representative Johnson.
Less for the recreational boater, but there was a bill introduced last session that had to do with ballast water exchange that I think, for those of us up near the mouth of the Columbia, found a very helpful, maybe not as rigorous as some would have liked, but a good first step, and I know you're familiar with it.
I was on that task force, and really we're trying to sort this thing out without being a burden that would deter freight into the state of Oregon, but I think where that task force is coming down, that it's really a federal issue, and we're really anxious for the feds to step up to the plate and start enforcing.
Well, they should, because at a minimum, I mean, our big navigable waterways are at risk, and who else knows what additional spread inland.
Well, there's the mitten crab and zebra mussel, plus the aquatic vegetation that You know, like I say, we're very fortunate that they have it in California, San Francisco Bay, and we're very fortunate it hasn't reached our shores. So, any other questions of our presenters? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We do have a sign-up sheet. I have, I'm going to murder this name, I'll bet you, Trey Parskadon, okay? Is there anyone else who has not had a chance to sign up in the audience who would like to testify? Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I'll only just take a few minutes here, very brief few minutes.
I need you to give your name.
My name is Trey Karskadon. I'm a resident of Tualatin. I'm a fifth-generation Oregonian. I made my full-time living in the marine industry for more than 20 years. My business represents some of the largest marine-related manufacturers and retailers in the state and in the region. My clients include Lumwell Boats, who's the largest well-aluminum boat manufacturer in the country, Smoker Craft Boats, one of the largest boat builders in the nation, with a plant just east of here in Staten, Stevens Marine, the largest boat dealer in the state, one of the largest in the region, several other boat and marine-related accounts. Currently serve as a board member for the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association. Serve on several committees with the Northwest Marine Trades Association. And I'm the government affairs liaison for the Portland Marine Dealers Association. And I thank you for entertaining my brief comments. I was fortunate to have received an invitation to sit in on one of several budget advisory groups for the Oregon State Marine Board. And I agree with the position of the Marine Board that if fees are not increased, essential services and facilities will be cut. The state's marine industry, a more than $1 billion-a-year industry that provides direct and indirect employment for more than 25,000 Oregonians, relies on a fully functioning, fully funded Marine Board to provide the facilities and the programs that our customers need. The proposed fee increases are reasonable. We believe they're prudent. Boating in Oregon is a tremendous value when given the broad resources we have available, the wonderful facilities, and the safety programs the board's initiated. Their efforts complete the circle for our businesses and help to stimulate people's enthusiasm to boat, and in doing so, stimulate people to purchase boats. And off of my script here, it's more difficult to be a boater today than it was 4 or 5 years ago. When the Marine Board came to us with mandatory certification, we knew what it meant, that would be potentially a hardship on our businesses, but we supported it statewide because it was the right thing to do. When you talk about fatalities, something that that we don't want, obviously, it's a real dark spot and something we try to overcome. This is one way that we overcome that. We have some of the most dangerous waters in the state on the face of the planet. Columbia River Bar, which I'm sure you're familiar with, is one of those. Folks take off out of Hammond, don't know what the buoys mean, run across Desdemona Sands, spend a tide there. You know, this basic education is a key to reducing the fatalities. People take jet boats, companies that I represent, in ankle-deep water, 35 or 40 miles an hour, it's full of rocks. Well, you know, we're fortunate we don't see more deaths. These people are trained, and they get the training, you know, through their experiences. Same thing with drift boats, same thing with canoes. We live in a very dangerous boating environment. I travel all over the country on these issues, and we're really unique in that regard. And the fact that we have as few fatalities as we have is a surprise to me, particularly when you look at bodies of water like the Great Lakes and areas like that that have much, much higher fatality rates, or at least maybe not per capita, but certainly in net numbers. A few years ago, we had the unfortunate occurrence on the Willamette River of a young girl dying who fell out of a boat as she was sitting on the gunwale. Dad made a turn, fell out of the boat, and drowned. And it was in the papers on the front page, and immediately the Marine Board responded with a mandatory life jacket law for all people in a boat under the age of 13, I believe. And it was, again, the right thing to do. We're fortunate to have the agency we have. The Without these reasonable increases, the cuts in the department will be deep. They'll definitely impact our businesses. We're sure of that. I've seen them firsthand, and I see what they provide to us. As an industry, we can't afford any downturn. We ask you to support these increases. And let me finish by saying, you know, there's that pervasive assertion that, gee, wouldn't it be great if government ran like private business? You know, and wouldn't this be a great thing? And of course, that's from an outsider's view looking in, and those are easy shots to make. But this is really an agency that I believe is exemplary. In all the ones that we have the privilege of dealing with in these open forums, they do an exceptional job. They serve their customers, the state's voters, I think, very well. In my more than 20 years in the marine business, I can tell you that I don't have an unkind word to say with them. They've been responsive. They've been fair. They've listened to us. They've responded to us. They understand their purpose, and we work very well with them. So I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Given that I'm making the assumption you represent mostly industries that are involved in motorized boating.
That's correct.
How would you believe the industry, the boating industry, and the people that sell watercraft, how do you think they would respond to a registration for non-motorized boats? And how could you support that?
I'm a... Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson, I'm a fiscal conservative. It's a little obtuse for me to come down here to the Capitol, away from my business, to ask to pay more money in the sport that I enjoy. But that's what I'd have to think about. I own a canoe, for instance. I own several boats. Canoe is one of them. And you can go out and you can buy at a garage sale a canoe for $100 or $200 or $500, brand new. They're not much for an aluminum canoe anyway, over about $700. So as a percentage of what that might be, my experience has been that I know lots of people who are multiple boats and are paying multiple fees. You have a guide and an outfitter that owns several rafts, for instance, or several drift boats. It seems to put an undue hardship on them. I know there's a lot of those craft out there. I'm not sure what the number is. I don't know that anybody knows for sure what that is, but I think it's ranged upwards of half a million. And that's what I'd have to think about.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Would your degree of comfort be brought up at all if accommodations could be made for guides that had multiple boats and that you knew that there were sideboards on the money so that it would go back into programs that create boating amenities and boating enforcement and boating safety?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the way that I view any of these increases is if that money is going to enhance the boater's experience, boating experience, that's where we start as far as analyzing these things. I'm really not comfortable, frankly, with an extemporaneous remark on that, without looking at it more closely. I don't understand the issue fully.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I'd like to make your point on the dangers of our waters. Representative Craig or Senator Dukes and I have had the opportunity to ride with the Coast Guard out on the Columbia River, and we're told that they train there for the whole United States because the Columbia River is probably the most dangerous place. It was interesting when I was on board, I don't know if I was with my other two colleagues, but we had a crusty old lieutenant, I guess, who was about ready to retire, and we'd had a presentation about how dangerous it is on the north, around the North Jetty. So I asked him, I said, tell me, from your experience, is this really due to the dredge spoils in this area, or is it just a very, very dangerous place? As a matter of fact, the day we were there, it was quite calm, but there was, 4 or 5 foot swells just absolutely coming from every direction. And I could see in any kind of rough water, you're not going to survive very well. But his answer was amazing to me. He said, Senator, I trained out here in, 1985 or something like that. And he said, we didn't even train in this spot right here. And that was before the dredge spoils were even in the area.
Mr. Chairman, when I was a kid, I used to spend summers. My father was in law school. The family would go down to Seaview and spend the entire summer down there. I worked on the charter boats out of Bilwaukee when I was in high school. I can remember as a kid looking up on the wall, and there was these framed pictures of all the boat wrecks, you know, the shipwrecks off the coast. And this dates way back into, you know, post-Lewis and Clark exploration. It's been a dangerous bar for some time, and I don't think it's been until recently that people have fully understood the dynamics of how these waters work. You know, with the Perfect Storm, I think, did a great job of that. You have these shallow bars like in the Nehalem or Tillamook or some of the other ones on the south coast. You have this water that builds up on a particularly on an outgoing tide, which people don't recognize. They don't know when to run the tides, and that's where the education comes in. And they find themselves in trouble, and then they tempt fate. And you know, water is a very powerful medium, and you don't recognize that until you're up against it. I've been boating. I'm 44 now. I think I started when I was about 12. I started guiding when I was in my teens and all through college, and then after college. And I know less today than I did when I started boating, and I have a deep respect for Oregon waters.
Well, and it's not just the inexperienced people, although the Coast Guard told us that is a huge factor, that people come from inland and go out on the Columbia. But Representative Miller's uncle, Mr. Moore, about 5 years ago, he and a partner who have lived in Bandon all their lives, went over that bar a million times, got caught on a wrong wave and drowned two of them. So it's even for the most experienced, they can get caught.
It can be barge traffic, it can be a log, it can be, you know, it can be an accident.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate your taking the time to come down and testify for us. There's been some more people come in the room since we started testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? Okay. With that, I think if there's no other discussion, I'll close the public hearing. Do we have any week that you're aware of?
No, Mr. Chair. Yesterday we left the agenda for the week here for you to look at, and nothing has changed.
Chairs have a meeting tomorrow at 8, and the full Ways and Means is at 10 tomorrow. Okay, with that, we'll close the meeting.
What is your floor section?